Hello and welcome to the Culturephile Debate. I'm Luke Clancy and today we're in front of a live audience at the National Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin as part of Dublin Book Festival 2025. Live audience, would you make yourselves known? There's a live audience of giant insects out there. And as well as me and the audience, we have a panel all poised to talk about critters we share our planet with, the ones that might scarper if you lift up an old log, the bugs, the insects, the creepy crawlies, the ones that, before today, you might have gone, ooh, at. Today, we're looking past the A-listers of that teeming world, the ones that get requested from tattoo artists, butterflies, bumblebees, ladybirds, and we're instead putting a tiny flashlight, and indeed a little tiny microphone, on the less loved invertebrates and isopods, because our question today is, do bugs need a glow-up? Should bugs work on their image? Do they need to do the work, or is it on us to down the disgust? Well, with me today to land on some answers and do a little bug PR are Rachel McKenna, who daylights as an architect and author and moonlights as a citizen scientist. Her most recent book is an almanac called Step Into Nature, and it invites us to engage our attention in wildlife, big and small. No fear, then.
No, none at all.
Next to Rachel is the head of the National Biodiversity Data Centre of Ireland and nature conservationist Liam Lycett. Back when it was founded, he was the first park ranger at the Burren National Park. Welcome, Liam. Did you have a uniform at that stage?
I did indeed, yes. Lovely teal blue. Ooh.
And also joining us is Cassia Gadden-Gilmartin, founder and managing editor of the bilingual literary journal Channel, where she publishes writing in English and Irish that looks to nurture our connection with the natural world. Welcome, Cassia.
Thank you.
And rounding out our panel is creative entomologist Nessa Darcy, who reintroduces humans to their natural habitat via close encounters with insects, and who's also been getting involved in ecotherapy recently. Tell us a little bit about ecotherapy.
Oh, wow. Straight in.
Straight in.
Well, to demonstrate, I was very nervous just before we started, but as soon as you mentioned isopods, I relaxed because I do find spending time with invertebrates calms my nervous system.
Yeah, so there's humans have a range of emotions when it comes to the creepy crawlies. And our panelists, what we've asked them to do is to select a bug to champion for us. And they've also to come up with a PR slogan for the bug that they will champion to give them a PR boost. And we'll be helped in that by Lee, who's behind me here, behind the laptop of doom, who's created a tiny soundscape for each bug, which we, funnily enough, on the radio would call a sting. So they have a sting for each of the creatures we're about to hear. And so let's have a wasp sting. The compositions are with Chris Watson, who's a sound recordist and has recorded insect and other small critter life from around the globe. So with that, they've made these new compositions. So that was the first of them, which was a wasp. And the guy speaking for these guys, the wasps, is Liam. Liam Lycett. Tell us, we've asked each person to invent a slogan for their little friend. So what's the slogan here?
Yeah, my slogan is don't wish wasps away.
So why not?
Well, wasps, I suppose, like brown rats, are perhaps the two aspects of our biodiversity that people really dislike. But wasps get a bad rap. I'm not actually talking about a species, but I'm making a plea for a whole family of wasps. And after my plea, I don't expect you to love wasps, but I would like you to understand wasps a bit more. The wasps that give the wasp family a bad rap are the yellow and black wasps that come into our kitchens in August and September looking for sugar. These are only two species, the common wasp and the German wasp. And yet they are the ones that are giving the family of well over 2,000 different species a bad rap. They come in looking for sugars after they've stopped tending to their larvae and their nests, and before they die off in winter. And it's that interaction with us that gives them a bad rap. And of course, for the rest of the year, they're going around doing their business, minding their own business, and not interacting with us at all, and we don't have any fear of them. And the wonderful thing about wasps are bees, everyone loves bees because we know that they pollinate. But actually, wasps are even better than that because they pollinate, but they're also voracious predators. They're preying on aphids, on flies, caterpillars. They're actually keeping our insect and ecosystem in balance. All of this is hidden. And as I mentioned, there's, although we, two species probably give wasps a bad rap, there are 120 different species in Ireland of what we call stinging wasps. And they're wonderful groups. They're social wasps. There's a group called the ruby-tailed wasps. There's spider-hunting wasps, and there's digger wasps. These are absolutely amazing creatures, performing an awful lot of absolutely really important services for nature conservation. And then once we go to the ichneumon gnats, the parasitoid wasp, we're talking about in excess of 2,000 different species. And these are ones that will voracious predators, and they'll prey on either a single species or a family of species. They'll use their venom to immobilize the insect, and they've got an ovipositor, and they'll put their egg into the usually larvae of a caterpillar or a moth, and the egg and the larvae will develop in there, and at one stage they'll live off the larvae, and then the adult will emerge and kill the creature. And the important thing that they're doing is, if you think about it, they're keeping nature in balance. If the predators aren't there, you'll get too much of a population explosion. So they're performing this very important activity. So they not only are they're pollinators, but they're predators, and we should be grateful for them.
So they're hardworking. I think that's your plea, is it?
They do a very important service. They all do this hidden. They don't do any harm to people. In fact, we benefit from them not being over. They're a very good gardener's friend. I think we don't tend to like them, but they're actually keeping, you know, ecosystem in balance in our gardens and elsewhere.
How are you on identifying them from the buzz? Can you tell one species from another?
The easier ones are the black and yellow ones because they're large. There's probably three or four species of what we'd call conventional wasps that are easy to identify. But as you go into the different groups, they become increasingly difficult. And once you get to some of the parasitoid wasps, you need a telescope and you need someone with a lot of knowledge.
And I guess they don't make that telltale sound so much when they're tiny either.
Yeah, well, the small parasitoid wasps are doing their business in the totally unseen from people. They're very, very active. But again, the key thing is that they're doing, performing a service to us, unknown to us.
Well, we have badges that everybody in the audience is holding, and I picked one at random so as not to be biased in this competition, and I got a wasp. So there must be a few of you out there who chose a wasp, because I noticed the wasp disappeared quite quickly from the tray for some reason. We'll find out later who was the wasp people. So, Rachel, you're going to be next. A thing that we call the shield bug, but gets known by different names and less charming kind of names. What's your slogan for the shield bug to begin with?
The slogan is the knight in shiny armor. And the reason for that is that they have a body that's sort of flattened and it's shaped like a knight's shield. And they come in a variety of colours and patterns. And they can actually change colour depending on the time of year as well, which is quite unusual. So some of them, like the gorse or the green shield bug, they're a lovely bright green during the springtime because they blend in with the surrounding foliage. And then they darken when it comes into the autumn.
Well, Lee has a soundscape for that. So that was a shield bug sound. Rachel, it's a beautiful sound. Is that what's attracting you here?
It's a very unusual sound. The sound I would normally hear is maybe them flying through the air, which is quite unusual because they're actually some of them can be quite large. So they vary in size. The smallest one is a scarab bug, which is only 3 to 4 millimetres. And the hawthorn is quite large. It's 13 to 15 millimetres. So you can actually hear those flying. And the reason they get their name and my tagline is a knight in shiny armor. It's because their body is kind of flattened and it's shaped like a knight's shield. And they also, within that pattern on their back, you get a variety of colors and different textures even. Some of them have little stipples on them. So they're very unusual. But the wonderful thing about them is that there's about 18 different species within Ireland. And a lot of those, you'd find them quite readily within your garden or on your local walks. And you'll find them within foliage because they are sap suckers. I thought that was another good maybe tagline as well, but it could be misconstrued. So they manage to do that. They suck out the plant juices with a very long, hollow, pointed mouth called a rostrum, which they stick into the plants. And not to be outdone by Liam's Ichneumon wasps and all the other type of wasp species, some of them actually are also predators. And they stick the rostrum then into caterpillars or into beetle larvae. And at one stage, I came across and took a photograph. It was a beautiful bronze shingle bug, and it was on a leaf. And I was there, oh, and look, there's a ruby tiger moth, the caterpillar, right beside it. I said, they must be making friends. And somebody says, no, unfortunately not. So there is this wonderful range of them. And as with all insects, each of the different stages is really, really fascinating. But one of the most fascinating stages, maybe, about the shingle bug is the different types of eggs. So they lay about 15 to 20 eggs, and they come in a variety of different colours and even different shapes. Some of them are very specific to their food plant. Some of them can vary from plant to plant. So ones like the birch shield bug, they've got kind of a pointed tip, and they split down the side when the little tiny nymph is ready to emerge. And then there's beautiful, the gorse shield bugs. They're like little bullseyes. So they lay them in two rows adjacent to each other on the little gorse flower. And they're black with a white circle around them. And the lid pops open when they're ready to come out. And one of the most exquisite ones then is the bronze shield bug. So they're a very dark, slightly shiny little cup shape. And they've got these hairs ringing around the top of the cup. And that's to try to stop predators climbing up inside them. And when the nymph is ready to emerge, the cup lid pops open and out crawls the little nymph. And inside you see this incredible iridescent layer on the inside of the actual cup, which is the most incredible thing to see and to try to photograph. So as with all of these, it becomes almost compulsive. You know, you try to find maybe the adult and you think that's absolutely amazing. You're there, where would we find them? And they're very much like ourselves. If it's a very windy or cold day, they're going to be down towards the end or the base of the foliage because they don't really like that. So if it's windy, you're not going to see too many of them. But if it's a sunny day and it's warm, they climb up to the top of the foliage and they sunbathe and bask in the sunshine up at the top. And that's when you might hear them actually flying away, you know, because they are quite large. So lots of different occasions to see them, either as a tiny little nymph, and they go through different instars, it's called, when they change for the different nymphs, and they go through five different nymph stages, and that takes about 6 to 10 weeks. So it's absolutely fascinating to see all those different stages.
So was there a moment when you thought, shield bugs, they're the one for me? I mean, it sounds like they're good looking, but like so many of our characters today, their behaviour is a little suspect for us, at least us humans.
Suspect in what way? I mean, they're absolutely incredible. And they some of them actually nearly have little personalities. So I was out looking for the gorse shield bug. And the minute they see you coming with the camera, they kind of shy away from the camera, so they're very bashful. Whereas the hairy shield bug, who gets its name from its furry little nymphs, because it's actually got long hairs, and you can see a beautiful necklace here that my sister made as a hairy shield bug. So they actually have this beautiful black banding down the sides of it and on its antennae. So it's much braver.
Not to life-size that. I'm...
No, it's not life-size. Don't panic.
Quite a large piece of jewellery.
But then there's the really endearing little parent shield bug. And she lays a little cluster of eggs, about 20 eggs, the sort of diamond-shaped mass on a leaf. And she actually protects those with her body. So she will stay over those eggs for the 2 to 3 weeks that it takes for the little eggs to hatch. And if you try and take a photograph of her, you obviously want to be able to see the eggs. So you lean to one side and then she leans over to that side as well. And then you try to creep around to the other side and she just gently leans over that way as well. So she stays with them for the full 2 to 3 weeks until they hatch.
Now
so how lovely is that?
I'm getting the charm.
I knew
I'm
it.
Getting
so go
the charm.
And swap that badge straight away.
I took it at random, I
yeah,
have to
right.
say. Thanks very much, Rachel. Next up, Cassia. Cassia, you want to advocate for this creature. We will hear a little section of before we even reveal what it is.
Thank you. quite lovely to hear them, actually. There's something a little spooky, but almost mystical as well about the sound of the earwig, which is what I've chosen to defend.
Tell us your slogan.
The slogan I've chosen in support of the earwig is "Too busy to burrow in your brain," which
because that has already come up with people in the audience. They said that's the one that goes in your ear, doesn't it?
Well, it's so deep in the public consciousness, and it's so old. This old wives' tale that they burrow into our brains and lay their heads there and cause madness. And the reason I've chosen that slogan is to poke a little gentle fun at this tendency we have as human beings to tell stories and make metaphors out of insect lives that speak into our own hopes and our own fears and probably say more about us than they say about the buds themselves. So in a lot of cases, that can be quite lovely. There's, of course, the classic metaphor of the butterfly as a symbol of change, but that's gorgeous. But for earwigs, they kind of get a bad rap out of it. Our instinct, I think, when we see them, when we see the pincers, is to leap to see them as disgusting, as a little bit scary, because they're creepy looking and they're nocturnal. They're the kind of creature that doesn't really want to have the little spotlight we're shining shone on it. They tend to hide away in damp, dark crevices and avoid light. And I think that speaks to all of the human fears that get wrapped up in them. They remind us of death and decay and of all of the unknowns that are out there at night. I went looking for some earwig poetry in advance of today to see what's out there. And it seems people have been scared of them since as early as the 17th century and probably much longer. I found a little sample from the 17th century English poet Robert Herrick, where he's talking about all of the fears that creep into the mind at night, and he talks about a short nipped sound from the earwig night that drops in my ear, associating the earwig with the night itself and all of the fear it brings.
I mean, I guess one of the roots of this sort of antipathy we have is, Lai and Chris have done work here to really exaggerate the sounds that, you're generally not going to hear that. Actually, mostly what you're hearing is kind of silence, and it's kind of that movement without sort of stirring the air that feels like it's at the root of some of the misgivings.
Yeah, they're actually very quiet little creatures. It's a pleasure to get to hear them because we so rarely do hear them. And I think what I'm getting at with the slogan as well is that they're actually busy living lives that are mostly invisible to us and that are very much their own. And if we look a little bit closer to them, we can find new metaphors, ones that still serve our purposes as humans, but that can help us revalue not only the earwig, but reconsider our values in a broader sense. Because we need stories about creatures that play the roles they do. They're really powerful decomposers. Omnivorous, but spend a lot of their time eating dead plant matter, breaking it down and returning nutrients to the soil. And I think we could use more stories and metaphors about that role, about that sort of almost mystical power that creatures like these have to break down the old and make room for the new. I think there's a lot of old that needs breaking down at the moment in today's world, and they're a little pretty that can help us do some of that imagining.
Well, there's a good case for earwigs if I ever heard one. Finally, Nessa, what bug are you championing this time before we hear it?
The woodlouse. Roly-poly role models.
That's the slogan, roly-poly role models. Get back to that in 1 second. So a soundscape for that too. A As I say, there's a degree of exaggeration involved in the acoustic process. One of the things that was suggested for getting insect sounds is that even with very good microphones, they don't move enough air. So what they do now is they project a laser onto the creatures and see vibrations from the laser and convert that into sound. That's not like listening to a bug, I'd say. Anyway, there were some pretty enthusiastic roly-poly role models, Nessa.
Yeah, well, I'm really enjoying live soundscapes. So actually, I'm finding them very meditative. But I can see how people who don't yet understand these insects could find them slightly terrifying. But you can. I have pet woodlice, and you can actually hear them sort of scuttling around in their little terrarium, and it's very calm, trundling noise.
I mean, it's a thing that people might find the creepiest of bugs, like the people might have the most trouble with. Is that what you find when you're trying to make people's acquaintance with the woodlice?
Yes, people have an issue with the fact that when you lift up a log, there are sometimes hundreds of them and they all scatter. Or the fact that they have 14 legs, and as someone recently mentioned, that they have all these gubbinses hidden under them that they keep secret until they roll over. So they're a bit of a hard sell, but I actually, yeah, I'm kind of guilty of ignoring them in the past myself, because they are so abundant. They're as common as muck, but without them, we probably wouldn't have a lot of the muck that we need to grow our plants, because they're also decomposers. They'll eat all the dead, nasty stuff we don't want lying around and turn it into nutrients. But I started getting interested in them when a kid in one of my workshops asked me if it was true that woodlice can carry their babies in a pouch like a kangaroo. And the kids do come up with some strange things in the classes, so I was like, I haven't heard that one before, but I'll look into it. And it's absolutely true. And they have all sorts of mad other lifestyle choices, like they have rectangular poos. They pee in gas form. They can eat their poos if they have food scarcity. What else? They've got blue blood.
This is impressive.
And of course, they were usually familiar with the fact that they can roll up in an adorable little ball when they get attacked by something.
When you're bringing people to meet the woodlice, you can't really show them the rectangular poo, can you? Or how do you encounter rectangular poo? Under the microscope, I guess.
Under the microscope, yeah. I mean, when you keep woodlice as pets, you get to see a lot of rectangular poo. They do. They'll turn these dead leaves and wood. You see the pieces of wood I put in the tank reducing in size, and they create this beautiful, silky, rectangular-grained soil.
So you were talking there about the stories that people told. There is a notion you were suggesting that we might make different stories about insects. And I guess that's part of the session here today, is that we'll make a different kind of story. What kind of stories should we be looking at?
Yeah, I think it's worth recognizing that habit we have of using insects, being a very different kind of creature ourselves, as human beings, as mammals, to serve our own concerns, and we don't need to stop doing it. It's where most amazing nature writing comes from. It's where that story of the butterfly that's been so powerful for so many came from. But recognizing that we do it gives us the freedom to start experimenting with how we might do it differently, and looking at buds anew and looking for the different stories they can tell us. And I think a lot of those stories are about renewal, the natural cycles of life, and coming to terms with those, even the disgusting parts, even the scary parts. I'm thinking, for example, of another poet we published in Channel, a wonderful young poet from Northern Ireland called Shatima Edwards, who the poem about the burying beetle, another genus of insects that plays a much more dramatic role in decomposition. They actually bury entire carcasses of small vertebrates like mice and birds underground as food for their larvae. And Shatima put together this little story of a mating pair of burying beetles burying a blackbird. And her words were, they make its tops a sacrament for their nursery. So when their tenorals emerge in June, it feels the air under their hindwings, which I think is just beautiful. This recycling of not only its materials, but in a sense, its spirit. And I think that that's the role that poets who write about buds can play, helping us to imagine something really beautiful in these processes of renewal.
The interesting thing about Channel, I find, is that it kind of, it appeared sort of almost in the midst of the pandemic, at a point when our interest and focus on this world seemed to increase as our social distance decreased, our interest in things that were tiny seemed to increase. And I guess that's where the journal arrives from. But have we faded in some ways from that position, that quality of attention that I feel like inspired the journal?
Yeah, I think we're struggling to keep it up. It was absolutely wonderful lot that we started publishing during the pandemic. Well, we just released our first issue, and then lo and behold, before we had launched the second one, a pandemic came along. And we thought that would be a great difficulty in terms of the ability to sell books and so on. But it also gave rise to all of these amazing poems. I remember a really fun one about bedbugs and entrapment with a partner in the home. It was a fantastic piece of work. And there's still a partlet out there. There's still a partlet of writers who are able to pay that really close quality of attention that we all learned to pay to the world during the pandemic. But now that life is getting busier again and opener again, we're struggling to keep it up en masse. So that, I think, is what conversations like this one are good for.
Rachel, your book, I don't know if everybody knows Rachel's book. It's a lovely book for holding in your hand, Step Into Nature. And what it does is it provides a way to look at the world around you. I mean, I were you aware of maybe the same things that we were talking about there, that you had a job to do in retelling this story in terms of the PR of the creatures you wanted to talk about?
Well, I think that was the whole thing. For me, it really was a personal awakening and an appreciation of the absolutely astounding beauty and complexity of nature around us. And it's the combination of how these different insects play out with each other, sometimes not so well for some of them, but it's absolutely fascinating. And I remember the first time I came across a ladybird in the garden, and it had something attached to its leg. And it turned out that a wasp had laid an egg inside the underbelly of the ladybird, and it takes a month to form in there. And as it emerges, it paralyzes the ladybird, spins the cocoon which it attached to the ladybird's leg, and then a week later, the adult wasp flies off. Now, apparently 25% of the ladybirds survive. I'm not sure how they quite tested all of that. Like, each day can provide you with the opportunity to listen to the voice of nature, perhaps not as dramatically as we just have, but if you just, by simply slowing down, listening and observing, we really can discover miniature wonders of nature. And these are wonders that can fill you with awe when you discover their complexities, or they're those that are just so heart-achingly beautiful that the memory stays with you long after the seasons fade. And, you know, each discovery can be classed as a small personal triumph. And such encounters have remarkable potency. Some have even described it as compulsive potency.
Thank you, Rachel. Of course, Liam, the other way of telling stories is through data. And I guess that's where you come into the storytelling here. I mean, tell us a little bit about what the point of biodiversity data is. I mean, is it a consciousness-raising exercise, or what does it do for us?
I suppose the starting point is you can't conserve what you don't know that you have. So that's the starting point. I suppose biodiversity or nature conservation does depend on being based on evidence and making sure that if you're deciding to do things for conservation, that actually they're going to work. Way too often, I think there's been initiatives in the past that are actually political of nature, but they don't actually progress very much. So really our attitude is the first starting point is you need to know what you have before you can conserve it. And the other element is we have to provide empirical data, information in terms of how nature is changing, because unless we know that, we can't really tackle it. It's really interesting actually hearing about you talk about engagement. I mean, one of the things that's apparent is that we've lost touch with nature in general. I think we're too busy, we're driving around the place, we've lost that engagement, and we've kind of lost the ability, I think, to tell these stories about our engagement. And there isn't a kind of a cultural literature or experience actually developing anymore. It's very much stuff that from the past. And I think, as I say, we're dealing with data and information, obviously to try to ensure that we can conserve biodiversity, we can conserve the ecosystem functions. And one of the reflections, I suppose, that I have is that actually the effort for nature conservation is totally devoid of wonder. And we're hearing these stories about creatures and the lives. They're magnificent, and there's a diversity and there's an intensity to nature that's out there. Yet it strikes me that everything we do for kind of nature conservation is just devoid of any sense of wonder. And I often describe it as kind of technocratic conservation. All that's important is writing a report and tracking what things are happening. And it's about as far removed from the day-to-day experience of engaging with nature that you can actually have.
Well, I'm very interested in the link between the two, because a lot of data collection is actually a demotic effort. It's about gathering people together. And that's a kind of a collective storytelling that people all over are involved in.
Well, I think Rachel gives a really good example of actually how she started opening her eyes, making a bit of time for looking at nature. And I think it's absolutely wonderful. It's a lifelong experience and learning experience that you'll never be bored a day if you're interested in biodiversity. Even on the wettest, windiest, miserable day in the middle of winter, there'll be something to keep an eye on. But that is, I suppose, that's part of our work. Ultimately, we want to try to build a case, a strong argument for conservation, that people understand the value of actually looking after nature, giving nature a bit of space, considering nature when we go about our business. And to do that, we're trying to expose people to the wonders of nature through data collection, through engagement, going out there, showing people how to look for nature, which is really important. That's Rachel's book has done that very well. You have to be shown how to look for nature, take a bit of time, how to go about searching for different aspects. So there's skill involved in that. But I suppose the kind of more scientific side then is that that's not enough if we want to actually influence the policymakers. We need really robust, systematically collected data to actually show how nature is doing. And I suppose in my naivety, I thought that if you could show the evidence to our decision makers, if you could show that, you know, some species of butterfly that once was common in the wider countryside has declined by more than 70% in its population, that if you present this information, that our politicians are reasonable and all that, and that there'd be a kind of a response in terms of policy. But I was a small bit naive in my thinking there.
So is it that we need a more general version of ecotherapy then that starts with decision makers?
Well, I think the challenge is to try to get them to engage on the issues and try to take it more important. Politicians are busy people. They tend to flitting from one, excuse the pun, from one topic to the other. But we tend, nature conservation, just for whatever reason, we can't get it. It doesn't resonate with those people who seem to be taking key decisions. Other issues, other factors tend to trump those in terms of what we're concerned about.
So, Nessa, you work often with young people, introducing them to nature. Have you got a plan for introducing Dorlaran to nature? Like, what are the steps that we literally need to take?
Well, I'm working on the next generation of politicians. I haven't quite got to Dorlaran
yet. You've given up on this generation, haven't you?
No. I think, I suppose when I'm moving into ecotherapy, it's partly because I've realized that it's a personal connection to nature that motivates us to try to protect it. So, and that also has vast benefits for the people connecting with nature as well. So it's kind of a two-way benefit.
Tell us, I mean, I asked you at the beginning, but maybe you could tell us a little bit more about the ecotherapy in terms of, like, can I book in with an ecotherapist and spend an hour, and what will I do and what's that going to do for me?
There are sort of forest bathing sessions where you might spend a few hours in the forest and do sort of guided mindfulness practices and nature connection practices. I'm going to be obviously focusing on insects with mine, so I like to bring creative processes into my workshops as well. One of my favorite things to do is actually just to spend time, to notice an insect, to spend time with that insect and just watch what it's doing, and sort of becoming fascinated with the insect kind of makes you very present. It kind of everything else just fades away. You're very present with the insect. And also, I've found that watching their kind of pace of life or the things that are important to them puts everything into perspective in my own life. And one of the things that I think is at the root of the damage that we're doing to the environment is this sort of idea that we never have enough, we're never good enough, we feel like there's a scarcity and we always need to be seeking more and more, whereas insects have a much more one day at a time sort of approach. And yeah, so I think I like to encourage people to spend time observing how nature moves and also the abundance that there is in nature. We are provided for by nature. We just have to calm down and slow down and only use what we need.
Are those the feelings, Rachel, you were getting when we were assembling the almanac, that you were entering into a kind of like a different way of approach? I mean, you said you had an awakening, but what are the effects in you of that awakening? I mean, even outside the world of observation and insects?
Well, I suppose, first of all, it is the whole thing of observing and about taking that time. And one of the big helps with that would have been the data centre, because they provide workshops. So you might attend workshops, you might go on field events. And then there's this whole thing about recording. And the more you go out to sea, the more you find. And that's a great line from the author Edward Stepp, who lent a hand in naming the book Step Into Nature. And he would say that when we're out and about in our local walk, he said, in finding what we sought, we're almost sure to find in addition something that is new to us. And that is just so true. Like, you might have gone out, first of all, you were looking for a wildflower. So you're down in your hunkers looking for the wildflower, and then you see something landing on it and you're like, oh, what's that? Or you're looking for something on a leaf, and then you turn the leaf over and you find a tiny little ball on the back of it that turns out it's a gall that's been made by a particular fly or a sawfly. And it's just the fascination that the more you see, the more you want to see. So it really does become compulsive. And as somebody once said, the whole thing of recording them on the data center, you know, the more you record, they have what's called a recorder league. And suddenly you start to see, oh, gosh, you know, I'm falling a bit behind, you know, or we need to get a few more records in our own county. And, you know, somebody said, would you class it as competitive? And a great friend of mine, he says that only losers say it's not a competition.
I did not know that data collection had become gamified in quite that way.
Yeah.
Is that good?
Well, we're not too sure. It's certainly a way of engaging certain competitive people in the process.
Pokemon was created by an entomologist, so that'll give you some idea of what we're like.
Amazing. Yeah, I think it's good because it goes with human nature, not against it. It goes with that competitive instinct we have, which can be a lot of fun.
Speaking of competitive instincts, it's come to the moment when we're actually going to see who's won, who's top of the league, who's the bug who will survive. And so I briefed our audience earlier about how to make this known. I mentioned that the show of hands was not necessarily great for the radio, but they all have a little bug badge, which I've invited them to flick at the appropriate moment. So I'm going to go through each of the bugs and see who the winner is. Okay, so we will start, if the wasp people would now begin flicking insanely hard at their badges. Okay, don't get worn out now. Okay, so that's a pretty good showing for the wasps, I've got to say. They're an early leader there. Okay. Is there anybody left for the shield bug? Feel there's an element of double voting going on here. But that's actually a good thing. Thank you very much. Now, earwigs. And woodlice. Is it possible that we have four winners? There's no way we could exclude any of those bugs. That was quite a fantastic insect landscape. Thank you all very much. And that's all we have time for. Thank you to our panel today, Rachel McKenna, Liam Lysett, Cassia Gaydon-Gilmartin, and Nessa Darcy.
Thank you.
Insectscapes were by Lee and Chris Watson. Niamh Day was the associate producer. This was a Sounds Doable production for RTE Lyric FM.